Die Presse.
Hi, mein Name ist Anna Wallner und ich melde mich heute ein letztes Mal für diesen Sommer aus Alpbach vom Europäischen Forum. Dort haben wir dieses Jahr wieder unser Kongressjournal in 10 Teilen für Sie produziert, einen Live-Podcast veranstaltet und ein Experiment gewagt. Auf Einladung der Redaktion des Monatsmagazins Pragmaticus, das zum Red Bull Verlag gehört, haben wir beim Forum Alpbach nämlich eine Live-Podcast-Kollaboration veranstaltet. 3 PodcasterInnen, und zwar Andreas Sator von Erklär mir die Welt, Karin Pollack vom Pragmaticus und ich vom Pressepodcast Was wichtig ist, haben live vor Publikum und auf Englisch die Direktorin der Dokumentationsstelle für politischen Islam, Lisa Fellhofer, interviewt. Jeder von uns dreien hat das etwas anders gemacht. Zuerst war Andreas Sator dran, dann ich, dann Karin Pollack. Nach dem 2. und dem 3. Teil gab es dann auch einige Fragen aus dem Publikum. Und Sie können jetzt den Live-Mitschnitt hier nachhören. Wir freuen uns jedenfalls auf Feedback, wie Ihnen das gefallen hat. Schreiben Sie mir unter podcast@diepresse.com. Ja, und ab morgen kommt dann Was wichtig ist aus der Sommerpause zurück und es gibt wieder jede Woche von Montag bis Freitag ganz reguläre Folgen um 18 Uhr, freitags schon etwas früher für den Start ins Wochenende. Kommen Sie gut in den September und zurück in die Schularbeitswelt.
Islamism as an obstacle to integration. Lisa Fellhofer. She is from the Austrian Fund. She is from the Dokumentationsstelle Politischer Islam, is the German word, the Austrian Fund for the Documentation of Religiously Motivated Political Extremism. This is our topic. We don't want to talk about religion, but about a radical movement. And we decided to split this podcast up to show kind of our different styles in working. And Lisa Fellhofer is an expert in this field. She is working for 4 years at the Dokumentationsstelle, and she's going to explain to each of us what she is doing. And you kindly ask to interact, not during the talks, but we have 5 minutes after each block, so you kindly requested to interact in this live podcast, as it is a live podcast, and you have then your voices on our track. So, Andy, please, could you start?
Sure, thank you, Karin. And I would like to say hi to Lisa. We talked before, I'm going to call her Lisa, she will call me Andreas, because that's the way I do my podcast. And first I wanted to ask all of you to welcome Lisa with a warm round of applause.
Thank you.
Lisa, just to get something straight in the beginning, Islamism and how it hinders integration. Let's just get to the basics. What's Islamism?
Well, that's the question that we work on at the Documentation Center. And it's very easy when you talk about violent Islamism, because when you have people who, in the name of their religion, want to blow themselves up and take as many people as they can with them, it's very clear what that comprises. But what about nonviolent forms? And that's what we're looking at. And basically, it's a very fundamentalist interpretation of religion. You have different brands, you have different forms of Islamism, and the thing is that a lot of them want to go back to the times of the Prophet and are very narrow in how they see their religious duties and rights and want to impose that on everybody else. So the belief is, do not just for myself or for my group. You have those too. You have those groups who are like, just for my group, I want those really, really strict fundamentalist rules. But then you have a big proportion of groups and movements that want to impose that on others, even within Islam. Because you have to, if you're talking about Islamism now during 3 podcasts, you have to keep in mind we're not talking about the religion of Islam. We're talking about the fundamentalist views, and these are putting pressure on all of the other interpretations of Islam that you have. So Muslims are the first that basically come under pressure by Islamists. And that's something that whenever we talk now, you keep that in mind.
But isn't that a natural thing to many religions, that if you are convinced that a certain person created the world and gave you these prophecies on how to live a good life or how to build or form a society, that you, if you're convinced that this is how the way the world works, that you want to convince others too?
Yes, of course. And that's also, you have fundamentalism in other religions too. The word fundamentalism basically goes back to Christian fundamentalism. And the Documentation Center is currently looking at Islamism and political Islam, but we are also able to look at other religious extremisms, which, if we have the time and the resources, we sometimes do. But yeah, that's something, especially in monotheistic religions, that's something that can happen. You have that in Judaism, in Christianity, where you have fundamentalists who want to impose their really strict interpretation on everybody else. So, of course, it's not something that is just pertaining to Islam or Islamism.
So could you summarize that Islamism, in contrast to Islam, is not just as a private way to interact with your religion in a spiritual sense, but as a political project to form society through a religious lens and not just live it in your private life, but make rules for everybody else, not caring about which religion they have?
Kind of, but the main point is for most Islamist movements that they have in some form or other are pushing back against modernism and modern developments. So, for example, if you take the Muslim Brotherhood that was created in the 1920s in Egypt by Hassan al-Banna, and it was partly as a pushback against the modernization of Egypt and a pushback also against colonial issues. You have the same for Turkey, where with the fall of the end of the Ottoman Empire and Kemalist Turkey, afterwards in the next decades, you have groups that want to go back to a religion-based society in order and started to advocate for that. So in one way or another, it's very often a pushback against modernization.
Could you give us, I know you're not an historian, but at least let's try to look a bit into history, because in Christianity, it was not always that Christians said, we don't want to have anything to do with politics. It was completely the opposite, and there was a century-long fight between politics and religion.
Yeah, so I'm a little bit on thin ice, as you said. I'm not a historian, but if you look at Christianity, you had for centuries this conflict about politics and religion, state and religion. I don't know if anybody of you remembers the history lessons, but what I remember is the Canossa conflict, when the Pope and the Emperor were fighting who has the say, and then you had this over centuries, and you have it also in philosophy. The thing is that Europe, over centuries, in different ways, has had a high blood toll over this fight of how much of a role has religion in society, in politics. And because of those experiences, like in France, if anybody knows the history of France a little bit better, you have the infamous Night of Saint Bartholomew, where the Catholics slaughtered Protestants. And you have the 30 Years' War, which was also about religion, and you had a lot of basically political failure that ended in people dying. And with that in the back of people's minds, there came this movement again of separating it. And that's what we have nowadays. We have secularism. Religion is still a factor in Europe, in European societies. I would not say it doesn't exist. But there is a clear separation, or sometimes it's not so clear, we have to admit that, but we try to keep it separate. And the big breaking point was basically, I here refer to Hannah Arendt, who pointed it out, when with the revolutions at the end of the 18th century, so French Revolution, also the American Revolution, you have this idea of human rights. and human rights that pertain to humans making the rule of law, being for everybody, everybody being equal, and God is not in that calculation anymore. And that's, again, then, if you come back to Islamism, a problem for fundamentalists, because for them, the highest is God and God's law. But we, as a secular society, are saying it's human law, and everybody needs to keep to that. So there you have the current conflict going on, basically.
And Lisa, what's the situation in Austria with Islamism? How much Islamism do we have in Austria?
That's always a difficult question, because I know that, especially for the media and journalists, it's always this question of how many do we have, how many mosques are dangerous, or how many Muslims might be dangerous. The thing is, we are talking, in most cases, the more fundamentalist, the less the numbers are. But they're so intolerant that even a small percentage can influence then the bigger majority. If you have For one example, we are doing, within our research projects, we sometimes do field work. And a while back, I had one of my field researchers come back and tell us about moderate mosque, where you have the Hanafi rite. So it's not a problematic mosque. The imam is as moderate as you can wish them to be. But they saw that within the services on Friday, there was this little group, like five people, of Salafi Muslims coming into the mosque and just attending the prayer and doing the whole rites within their more Salafi style rite. They did not impose anything on the rest of the congregation. But my field researcher, who himself has a Muslim background, he came back and he was like, this is not good, because 10 years ago, the imam and the congregation would have told those four or five people, leave, go out, we don't want you here. Now they accept them. So it's small incremental changes like that, and we need to support the moderate masses to help them keep pushback, something like that.
I imagine it's very difficult if you look at the international picture. You talked about Iran, and we have many Muslim countries in the world are kind of part of this movement with a pushback against modernization, with Islamism, with no separation between state and religion. And if you have a modern, globalized, digital world where people and Muslims can connect throughout the world, and you have, maybe you try to push it a little bit into a more progressive, Western, liberal, modern interpretation of Islam, and then you have people in Riyadh, in Ankara, in Tehran, and in all these countries with many influential universities, degrees of political Islamic theology. I imagine it to be really difficult to get some grip on that.
Well, kind of. You need a lot of resources. You need people with a different educational background and knowledge. So for illustration, the Documentation Center right now has around, let's say, 14 people working for us. The majority are in research and documentation. And you need, so that sounds like a lot of people, but you need people who have done Islamic studies or Orientalism studies. You need people who speak Arabic, speak and read it, who are able to understand what's being said. You need people who have the theological knowledge to be able to discern, is this something that's just a theological dispute which doesn't concern us as an Austrian institution, but is it something that goes against democracy, rule of law, and human rights? You need people who speak Turkish, because Turkey is a big player in this area, unfortunately, I have to say. You need people nowadays also who speak Dari Farsi, so the languages of Iran and Afghanistan. There's a big Afghan community in Austria, also in Germany. And, for example, if you look at the Afghan community, there you see a big heterogeneity, a lot of people who are against the current Taliban regime, but then you have sympathizers and you need to look at those. So that's difficult. So you need a lot of languages that you cover. And I didn't even mention the Bosnia, Croatia, Serbia language, because you also need those. And in the beginning, when I took over, I'm the first director of the documentation center, and we built the whole thing up in the last 4 years. And I remember that in the beginning, somebody told me, well, you cover the Turkish stuff, and then you will be done, and then you have nothing to do and twiddle your thumbs. And now, 4 years later, there's still movements and ideologies that we still need to look at in detail. So the work, unfortunately, doesn't stop.
And could you give us a little overview on what Austria does and the different Austrian governments do in this regard? Because we have the Islam Gesetz since 2015. We also started a degree at the University of Vienna with Islamic theology to try to have education on Austrian floor and not have imams being educated in Cairo or in Riyadh or in Tehran, where ideology is a lot more conservative. Could you give us a little overview on what's happening in this regard?
Well, you already mentioned two big points in this area. So the Islam Gesetz, the law on the religion of Islam, was introduced introduced in 2015. But you have to remember that Islam as a religion has been recognized in Austria since the early 20th century during the Habsburg Empire, because Bosnia was annexed and you had a big Muslim population then. And it was for pragmatic reasons also, due to military reasons, to be able to integrate Bosnian Muslims into the military and give them, like, have an imam come in and everything. So in that regard, Austria has been a little bit of a pioneer over the decades. You have the university studies, which I think is a good thing. It just takes time. And sometimes it feels like we're running out of time because these are recent measures. In the more negative area, I would say, Austria introduced a law on symbols in, I think it was 2014, if I remember correctly, that forbids Islamist symbols in Austria. So if you see somebody making the sign of the grey wolves with their hand, I'm not making it now, but it's a very distinct gesture, or if any symbols from Hamas or Hizbut Tahrir or any other group is being shown somewhere in Austria, you can get a fine, and it's basically forbidden. So there's things that are being done. But what's important is also the daily living together. And I think there's time to talk about that a little bit later, but it's not just legal measures that need to be taken.
Thank you so much, Lisa. And I would like to open up the floor, your chance to ask follow-up questions on the things Lisa said. Who wants to be the first person? Always gets sympathy with the people on the panel. Then we just continue our conversation.
Okay. When I first started to prepare our talk, I had the three cancelled Taylor Swift concert in Vienna in my mind, of course, and the suspected attackers with a radical Islamist background. But then just recently, last Friday, another Islamist attack happened in the German town Solingen. So we can see that these kind of attacks happen more often, or they seem to come closer. Of course, we should not generalize them. Each attack is different. But what we can see is a rising Islamist radicalization throughout the internet, social media, and other internet rooms. I would like to know how the documentation center can observe these echo chambers or echo rooms, and how can you track down and infiltrate these echo chambers in which radicalization happens?
Well, first of all, we don't infiltrate. Mm-hmm. So because we are a research-based organization, we work only with open source information. So that means if there's something on Twitter, on Instagram, TikTok, we have that on the radar. If it's a closed group on Telegram, that's a no-go. So we can't do that. I mean, there's the current debate in Austria about Telegram, mm-hmm. anyway, and closed social media groups, how to get into those. We cannot do that. We only work with open source information, which is sometimes enough. We published a study, I think 1.5 or 2 years ago, a mosque in Vienna, where over the course of 10, 15 years, somebody, we don't know who it was, it must have been somebody from the congregation or even the imam himself, put up the Friday prayers of the imam on YouTube. And I think they felt very secure because it was in Arabic and they might have had the attitude of, well, nobody in Austria at the administration or authority level understands it anyway. And the other perspective that my researchers are taking is also they wanted their congregation to be able to follow them online. So that's, sometimes it's very easy like that. So we do that. We are not exhaustive in covering all of that. We have to focus on certain groups. We are not a controlling instance. What we're doing, we identify movements, organizations that might have a link or a base in Austria, and then we try to see, okay, what are they doing online? We published something a while ago on 3 groups that are based in Germany who are very active online, who are very good in that online-offline communication. They put up videos that I'm Generation MTV. I'm like, this looks like an MTV video. It's very professional. And I watch it. It's 2 to 3 minutes with music, hip-hop style music. They have hoodies on. They have the big Mercedes that they drive around in Hamburg. And it's like, okay, so what's next? What's next? You fall into that. You want to see what the next video is. And the next video is a guy who then will tell you something about their rather strict view on religion. So we look at those, even if they're not in Austria, but because they're to a German-speaking young population, that's the target group, we still analyzed what they did. But to really cover everything, especially if it's TikTok, that would take a lifetime, I think, to actually do.
Okay, so you do the research, you look into it, but what happens next? The question, or the reason why I ask you, is because I wonder if you do something like, if you publish something like a list or something where schools or other education, whatever institutions, can have something like a guideline what to do if they realize that especially young kids follow these influencers or Islam. We talked about it like, would say it Islamfluencers or Islamistfluencers. Or what can the society do about this?
Well, our task is to research, analyze, and document, and then publish it and inform the public, the general public. So that's the main thing that we're tasked to do. What we also do is trying to keep contact with organizations like the Islamic community in Austria. So I try to at least once or twice a year meet President Wural. I know they're very skeptical about us, but he always sits down and listens to us. So I have to say, we try to keep in contact with them. Also inform them if we find something at a mosque that is under their authority, so that whatever they decide to do with that. If we find something that pertains to criminal law, then we actually hand it over to the authorities. That's not our area anymore. Unfortunately, that has happened a few times. We had gotten knowledge of a mosque close to the University of Vienna, where the imam himself has declared that he, in interviews, that he is adherent to the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood. And he had some anti-Semitic statements in his Friday speech. So we handed that over to the authorities. But we also, again, informed the Islamic Authority, and I think they took care of it, and now there's an imam who's rather moderate. So stuff happens behind the scenes there. What we also do is we now hold like information awareness workshops where my people tell teachers or interested persons what the difference is between Islam and Islamism. That's always the first point. Because what we don't want is a generalization about Muslims and Islam. So to be able to distinguish what the difference is. And part of that workshop also always is signs of radicalization. So how can you tell what are indicators that a young person or anybody actually is getting radicalized by those, for example, social media influences. And that's what we're doing. We're not publishing lists because that is a little bit too, I don't know. It's a little bit too difficult.
And it might also change a lot. I mean, these are things that the internet is a world wide web, so you might publish something, put names on or accounts on that, and next week there's a new one. You mentioned that the Islamic authorities are critical or skeptical towards the documentation center. Could you tell us why?
Well, for one reason, it is, I think, the fear of a general criminalization of Muslims. I think that was also the debate back when the Documentation Center was founded. In the media, there was this whole thing, this is another building block for right-wing extremists to build on to say all Muslims need to whatever. We have very hard tried in the last few years to show that we are actually looking at the extremists and the fundamentalists, and what we want, what we are doing, should help the Muslim community to be able to still, within religion, freedom of religion in Austria, be able to practice their religion, but not get under the pressure of Islamist movements. The problem also is, I think, but you would have to ask them, that some of the organizations we're looking at with a very critical eye are part of the Islamic Authority. So, for example, we are looking at the Milli Görüş movement, which comes out of Turkey, was founded by Necmettin Erbakan, and he's one of those who wanted to push back against the laicist, Kemalist Turkish state and wanted to go back to basing society and politics on the religion of Islam. And so, obviously, there you have a conflict of interest if within your structures you have organizations that we are actually looking at with a critical eye.
When we hear about terms like TikTok jihadists or hipster Salafists, I wonder how much you look also into this progress. How long does it take to get someone, get a kid, I don't know, with 15, to catch it with these videos or whatever? You mentioned before that it's always a mixture between analog and digital influence. Could you maybe emphasize a bit more how easy that is and how long it takes to influence someone to become a TikTok jihadist or jihadist who goes out and wants to kill people?
Don't have any studies on that right now, but I can tell you a real-life example that one of my people undertook. Not so much with the Islamist influences. It was more, it wasn't at work, it was more in the private life. And then they came back and they were like, this is really fast, how that happens. They went on YouTube and they just wanted to look up how to repair their shoes because they had some fancy shoes and they wanted that to repair those instead of throwing them out. And then there was the next video on do-it-yourself style issues, and then suddenly, the next few days, the suggestions by the algorithm on YouTube, we're not talking about TikTok, which is even worse, but YouTube, suddenly he got suggestions for prepper style videos. You know, those nut cases who think that the end of the world is near and they're building a bunker, and he was like, this was within a few days. And he didn't, the only thing he did was searching how to repair his shoes. So that's just an example how fast that can go. But what we are seeing and what we also hear from social workers is that it's not just the algorithm online. And it's I think we shouldn't be blind as a society to the, as you said, analog issue, because you have the online factor, yes, and that goes very fast and it spreads very easily. But you always need the anchor, a person on the ground. And we have heard from, as I said, social workers, people working with, persons working with young people, that there are like hodjas or imams or authority figures, older men, sometimes with younger men, going to the basketball place, to the football cage in the city, to the fight club, to whatever, where you find young people, and they talk with them. They just conversation, this is my friend, this is my brother, and then they talk. And so you have both levels, online and offline, and that at the moment is a very dangerous mix.
And I would like to look closely at one of these influences. We talked about Abu Bara, who is quite famous right now in Germany, and was also now mentioned a lot when it came to the suspected attackers around the Taylor Swift concert in Vienna. Who is this guy? What is he doing? Because his videos you can find very easily online when you look at TikTok. And it always, when I look at it, I'm always like very surprised that the way how he does it, it works, because it's, how should I say, he doesn't really look cool or something, yeah? You know what I mean? So who is this guy and why does he work and who is funding him?
He's a TikTok preacher out of Germany. I think he's based in Berlin, as far as I know. Through the years, on and off, my people had him on the radar, but since he's in Berlin, there was always this, well, you know, we have limited resources, we can do only so much. But he's interesting. He's a Salafi style preacher. You see, when you see his videos, it's very clear that he's adherent to the Salafi orientation, because the way he's dressed, his beard, everything is clearly that direction. And he has a dry wit. He has funny little videos. Some of them are a little bit absurd. I'm not sure if I remember it correctly, because my memory sometimes fades with that stuff. But there are instances where he takes mundane issues, like something's in your household isn't working, and he's making fun of it. Haha, that doesn't work. And then he's like, you know why? Because you might have a djinn in that machinery, and then you need to go get somebody who exercises the djinn. And then that's funny little videos. Even I am like, hey, I would never think of that, but okay, yeah, if you believe that, fine. I'll call the repairman. If you call somebody else, that's your issue. But the problem is that then the next video is more serious. And he's talking about core fundamentalist views, like very strict segregation of gender and pushing back against the Western idea of rule of law and stuff like that. So that's an issue. The interesting thing after the Taylor Swift thing was that he and Pierre Vogel, who's a very well-known Salafi from Germany, Pierre Vogel is actually a convert, a German convert, and they were publishing a video saying, trying to distance themselves, because there was this allegation in the media that the guy from the Taylor Swift concert had been influenced by him, and that they are trying in the video to dispel any connection to that has to do with what you need to keep in mind. The terrorist guy in Vienna was apparently pledging allegiance to the Islamic State, and Salafi is not necessarily like Daesh or Islamic State. So there's a conflict there.
Groups, yeah, which is interesting. I would also to you and give you the chance to ask questions to Lisa.
Thank you for the discussion. I would like to ask three questions. So first of all, is there a clear definition on who is a moderate Muslim? And why don't we hear about moderate Buddhists? What makes Islam as a religion stand out in this regard? I just wonder if you can briefly summarize. And then the second question is, a lot of the times when we look at news, when there are crimes committed by Islamic terrorists, in the report, they always say, this man, usually they are men, this man has been previously alerted to the authorities. But I wonder, what can the government do to prevent such crimes when they have already been alerted of such individuals? And then thirdly, ever since Twitter became X, is there additional difficulty for authorities to identify radicalized extremists in general, whether Islamic or not? Because some time ago, I did stumble upon an account where there is this British Islamic person, and in his account, he constantly posts very radicalized comments, and he even posted a photo to showcase his gun collection, which is illegal in the UK. So I reported it to X, but then X got back saying, we did find the content of the post you reported to not comply with German law, because I reported in Germany. But then what they did was to simply not display the posts in Germany. Thank you very much.
Yeah, for the last one, with, I still call it Twitter, I cannot get to calling it X, I'm sorry. That's an issue. On the European level, the Digital Services Act was introduced to be better able to handle that kind of stuff. But I think, and that's the result then, that within Europe or within European countries, that content isn't displayed, but then outside of Europe, it's still online and you can still see it. That really is an issue, and it doesn't only pertain to Islamists. You have it also with, so unfortunately, we get a lot of stuff, not just the Islamist stuff. You also have it right-wing extremist stuff. And so, I don't know, it has evolved into something very destructive for a democratic rule of law-based society where tolerance is a main pillar. And actually, I'm happy or glad I'm not a politician to have that headache on how to deal with that. I can just say, yes, it's gotten worse, but I don't have a remedy for that. The first question, moderate. No, I don't have a definition. It's already tough to get a definition on Islamism and political Islam. When the Documentation Center was founded, there was this huge public debate, also in research, what is actually meant by that term. And it's still ongoing. And actually, in academia, it's fine. You fight over a definition forever. The problem is, if you continue fighting always over the definition, then you never get to actually look at the issue. But generally, if you are practicing your religion, be it Buddhism, Islam, any Christian denomination, in a rule of law-based society within the norms and values that go back to human rights, and if you don't try to cut off others from their fundamental rights, you are fine. We have a problem as a society. If somebody claims to make use of his right of freedom of religion and then turns around and tells everybody else that their religion is not okay, even within Islam. So that's conflict of interest. But honestly, the answer is there's no clear definition, unfortunately. But we would need to strengthen the moderate part of Muslims, definitely.
So.
And I forgot the third one. I'm sorry.
I did not. I just want to jump in for the last part. And my question would be women in Islam. We see them, they have the hijab, the veil that they are carrying. What is, in all this discord about radicalization, polarization, violence, where are the women?
That's a very complex issue. And the interesting thing is there's always this idea in Western debates that women are oppressed and by the Islamist ideas. And what is neglected within that is that if you look at Islamism, you have women's movements in Islamism. So you have women engaging and working towards a fundamentalist idea of Islam, because for them, it means a kind of liberation. And it's in conflict with our idea of feminism. But these Islamist women also say that they're feminists. So that's an interesting thing that is happening. And you can disagree, obviously. Because if you have groups, like I mentioned earlier, those Germany-based groups who are on social media, one of those groups is not just online, they also do sometimes like activities on the street, like a demonstration against the discrimination of Muslims. And when you look at those demonstrations, there's always a clear gender segregation. The men are always in front, and the women, and almost all of them are veiled. All of them are veiled. I don't remember actually any woman who isn't, are in the back. So there's always but they are there. It's just that there's gender segregation.
But how patriarchal is Islam in terms of Islamism? And we're going to talk at the end about democracy and about the same rights for everybody. So is this something that plays a role?
It plays a role, especially in that, you know, juxtaposition with how we see equality of men and women. But the role of women is very defined, and it's not just in Islam. It's in all big monotheistic religions that there is a very patriarchal approach to the role of men and women. So it would be not correct to say that's just Islam. I mean, if you look at the Bible, and that's always my favorite example when we are talking about veiling and the whole debate about the hijab. I'm not taking a position for or against, I'm just saying that there's always this discussion about, is the Quran saying that you should or shouldn't? And nobody ever mentions that, well, in the Bible, in the New Testament, one of the letters of Paul, there is actually a demand for women to veil themselves. But we wouldn't do that. We don't adhere to that anymore. So you see, if you go back to the scriptures, it's different. But the question is, how are we living it in modern times?
Yeah, but talking about democracy, it's the right, the freedom of speech. So everybody can utter whatever he wants. And in your report that the Dokumentationsstelle did, is a very interesting thing that Islamists are requesting the liberty of speech against democracy. So this is the weaknesses of democracy that they are challenging. Could you comment on that? Because I thought it's super interesting.
Yeah, that's actually the main point of our work. Because, as I said in the beginning, we are not working in the security area of the whole debate. We are not looking at terrorists or jihadists who, it's very clear that they want to hurt other people. We are looking at exactly that. And it's the what Karl Popper called the paradoxon of tolerance. How tolerant can a society, can a tolerant society stay tolerant if they are so tolerant that intolerance takes a hold? That's what we are currently seeing. And we have looked at it also from a legal point of view. And there's the interesting thing that nobody ever talks about. In the legal circles, they do sometimes, they do, but in public debate, we don't really. And I think we should do that more. We have the European Convention on Human Rights, and within that you have the freedom of religion, freedom of opinion, freedom of equality, etc. But within that you also have article, I think it's article 17, that says none of the freedoms of this convention can be used against the convention's freedom. So the moment where you are using your freedom of opinion or freedom of religion to undermine the declaration or the Convention on Human Rights, then you are outside of that right, outside of that freedom. And as a society, as also the state, we need to keep that more in mind, which is pertaining not only to religious extremists, but also to other extremists.
Yeah, so but in the discussion, and the Pragmaticus did a special issue, the cover story of our magazine, is about values. And what are values? I mean, democracy is a value. Our jurisdiction is a value. Same right for women and men are values. So how could you just get through with all these difficulties, because Islam is not Islam and it's a very differentiated picture? So how can you interfere? How can you put up this value catalog? Is it possible?
Yeah, that's what we're trying to do on a daily basis, and we have heated debates within the team sometimes. Our current model of how we live is based on three pillars. It's democracy. But democracy alone is not everything. I mean, you can be an illiberal democracy, you can be just a normal, I mean, even Iran has elections, so there you go. Democracy alone is not the solution to it. So you have democracy, you have rule of law, which means equal rights, the law is the basis for everybody. And then you have human rights. And the human rights are basically what we in our daily work also use then as that threshold. So anything that goes against, for example, equality, minorities, falls within that. And for a practical example, I'm just trying to think of it, one or two. If you have, well, like we found, unfortunately, books that are distributed out of Turkey, and those books are sometimes in Turkish, but very often they're printed in German, and there is a series of books, publication house, an Islamist publication house, basically, and what is being said about the roles of men and women in that book is very concerning. For example, one of the statements is that a husband has the right to hit his wife if she refuses to sleep with him. And if the parents also, or the husband has the right to hit the kids if they're not obeying. So that's all stuff that we have gotten rid of, fortunately, but it's still within those books. And that's where we need to say, no, within our framework of rule of law, that's not acceptable.
Because I want to cite one book that in previous years in Alpbach was always the topic, The First Political Order, Valerie Hudson. So that the family is the first cell that forms a state. And if women and men are not equally acting in this little cell, it's going to be transparent in the overall society. So my thing is, if it's because it's privacy, everybody can do in his family whatever he wants. So what is your, how could one engage with these communities, and how can one bring these values of not beating up children and not beating up women? How can one educate people who are still used to do that, and probably because of religion?
Well, in the case of the book, it's like saying that this is not acceptable, and then trying to get that out of the, you know, circulation. But I think the most important step, but that's a little bit outside of our working area, the most important step is to talk with the community and support those forces in the various communities that are speaking up and holding against that pressure of Islamists. One example that I can think of here in Austria is Mrs. Fatma Akatürke. She used to be the female spokesperson for the Islamic Authority, and she published a book about women's empowerment in Islam. And she's one of those voices. So just help, and she's under a lot of pressure, I think, from within the community, just helping those people, support them and strengthening them. Your average Muslim living in Austria, like some of the people who work for me, who have different views on issues, and they just want to be living their daily life without being under the pressure of having to do everything that fundamentalists say they should do. So I think, but that's something for everybody. It's not just the state needs to do that or politicians need to do that. That's something for everybody. Like my mom, her neighbor is a lady from Syria, so just talk with her. And I think that's the basis for everything, even for democracy. We need to talk just like we did, have a conversation, exchange information, opinion. That's also one of the backbones of our society, I think. This ability to talk, not always agreeing, that's okay, but just talking about the issues. And I think we need to take care to not lose that.
Good, we're coming to an end. And there has been one question that I postponed.
Hi there, I'm Thomas from Sicherheitsbewusst Podcast. I love this panel, it's great. I would like to focus on your daily work and recent developments. So we're going back to school now next week in Austria. Do you also cover the official Austrian education system? If yes, do you observe tendencies of Islamist radicalization there? And if yes, how do you react? And I've got a second question. Also, recently, after a wave of demonstrations, mostly taking place in Vienna, on how are Islamist propaganda and anti-Israel Free Palestine Gaza protests interlinked?
Thank you for the last question, because I actually wanted to talk about it, but I forgot about it. So even before October 7th, anytime something happened in the Middle East with Israel, Gaza, and Palestine issue, you could see that the Islamist activists were taking that as a surge in their activities. But it always remained, you know, it flared up and then it went down again. October 7th has been like pouring gasoline into a fire. You have those activists online and offline who use that. And the longer the current operations and conflict is going on, the worse it gets. Because in the beginning, I mean, even in the beginning, immediately on October 7th, you had Islamist groups celebrating. You had that that group in Berlin that is now prohibited, Sami Dun, handing out sweets because finally the resistance did something. And the more, the higher the death toll and the more horrible pictures you see out of Gaza, the worse it becomes, because even non-Islamists, Muslim or non-Muslim, who are invested in that conflict emotionally, see that and take sides. And you have only black and white. There is no gray anymore in the middle, in between. You cannot seriously talk about that issue anymore without immediately having pro, contra, and almost like fighting, which is the worst that can happen, because there's no solution at the moment. And the worst thing is, from an Austrian and European perspective, that it happens there. And what we have seen here in Europe is that the Jewish community has been attacked and is still being attacked for being Jewish. And that's something that should not happen. But it's a very difficult issue, and we can see how it just continues and strengthens a lot of the online activists and Islamists with their narrative. And that then goes to the first question with the education field. We don't have a research project going on at the moment, but we talk with people in the field of education, and the Israel-Gaza conflict is a main driver of a lot of developments. And yeah, it's going to be difficult. It was difficult already last year, and it's not stopping to be difficult. And that pressure, I talked about that from the very fundamentalist players. You see that sometimes also in the field of education, in the school. You have a small minority, mostly young males, of pressurizing their environment to follow their strict form or perspective of Islam. But sometimes you have other examples, like a few years, that's not a current issue, but a few years back, I remember there was actually an article in the magazine Biba about young Chechen women who were using the Quran against the Islamist boys, trying to tell them how to live their life. And the girls actually looked into the Quran, and then they said, it's not written here. You have no right to tell me that. So sometimes they take the religious basis and then can push back towards that, if they're smarter.
Okay, there was one question here.
Yeah, hi, I'm an anti-racism activist in Vienna and also a middle school teacher. I teach at a so-called Brennpunktschule in the 22nd district, so I work with a lot of the kids you've been talking about. And my question is just, I see in my day-to-day work how segregating our system is, and that a lot of the kids don't really have any perspective, so that's why they often tend to fall for this kind of rhetoric. So how do you see your role in preventing these young people to fall for that kind of rhetoric? And also, do you actively problematize the failing of the Austrian government, like the education system, to give these young people like actual perspectives outside of radicalizing themselves? Or do you see yourself more as like, just do you just release the numbers of your research? Yeah, that would be my question.
Yeah, we are more the research and documentation branch of what you can do. But as I mentioned, what we are doing more and more now is talking with teachers, but also people from other areas, social workers, because not everybody knows about Islam. And there's this big danger of just throwing everything into one pot and thinking that's just a religion and everything is bad. And what we are trying is to raise awareness, what's the difference, what are signs of radicalization, what is problematic, what is not problematic. I can give you one example. We had, I think it was last year, a teacher from Styria contacted us, and he had a question because in his school, one of his pupils was putting graffitis up and writing on his school books everywhere and Arabic, something in Arabic. And they were very concerned. He was very concerned. He was like, what is this? Is this like inciting violence? And then my people who speak Arabic and the person who has a theological background looked at it and were like, no, this is the most unproblematic verse that you can find in the Quran. That young boy just probably wanted to, you know, be a little bit of a troublemaker. So we can help with that. But if you, to actually be in prevention with young people, there's other institutions like the Beratungsstelle Extremismus in Vienna, and there's a whole network for prevention within Austria. They also talk with each other. So what we do, we give information and we try to help as much as we can, but we don't do groundwork.
So the last question, because we run out of time.
Thank you. I'm Michael Breisky, retired Austrian ambassador. I missed most of the talk, unfortunately. However, I have a remark, maybe redundant. In the book I'm presenting this afternoon, with the title To Understand and Love Europe, I also identify 7.5 factors of European identity. And the half factor is Islam, because it's still open whether Islam can become a European factor of European identity for the obvious reasons stated in some of the Medina surahs. Now, there is an element of hope, and that element is the brotherly agreement signed between Pope Franciscus and the Sheikh of the Al-Aqsa University in 2019, where they agreed to have brotherly relations. And having brotherly relations also involves the recognition of the dignity of man. And I think this is the element of hope. Thank you.
Would you agree?
I agree, but I'm also a little bit more pessimistic because you have those various movements who are fundamentalist and who don't necessarily take that view. And you have this fight within the religion of Islam currently going on. But I agree. And one should never forget that, for example, there is parts of Europe that have had Islam as a religion over centuries. And I remember I worked for 10 years in the field of integration. And we always used to say that Bosnian Muslims, that's the example how it should be done, because they're Muslim, but they are within the European frame, and you would never have debated that they're outside of it. So I half agree.
So thank you very much. Unfortunately, I mean, this is a vast topic. We could go on for hours and hours, and if we would be privately, probably we would. You would, because you have all the time in the world. Thank you very much, Andi Sato. Thank you very much, Anna Weiner. Thank you, Lisa Fellhofer, for this interesting talk.
You.
I think the overall takeaway is black and white doesn't exist any longer in digital ages, and you have to look very carefully. And what is happening with polarization is that they put things too simply. So let's look at it as a takeaway in a differentiated way. Thank you very much for the public for listening to this live podcast. And on the 1st of September, it's going to be released. So I hope that you're going to download it either on Erklär mir die Welt, on Was wichtig ist, or on the Pragmaticus podcast. Thank you very much. Good day.
Die Presse.